blind spot assist. What's that about? Looking in mirrors.
That's my golden rule on holiday. I'm not going on holiday anywhere that is worse than where I already live.
Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the Classics World Chat Show, a cabaret of classic car conversation where we'll peel back the verbal vinyl roof and enjoy some open-air automotive chat. I'm Phil Whedon, and I'm joined by my regular co-host, Joe Miller. And as Jeff Ruggles is on 400th holiday of the year, I'm joined by our other fellow frequent flyer, Jamie King. Welcome.
Hello. Your intros are getting worse, by the way.
Just running out of ideas. Eventually, I'll just say hello. We're going through a summer holiday period where there's lots of people away and we're trying to juggle schedules. So consequently, this episode is being recorded a couple of weeks earlier than it might have otherwise been. So the idea of talking about news might seem slightly farcical, but I will at least report on the news in Classic Car Buyer from the end of August edition, which did give us some updates on the Bewley Motor Museum stuff.
Yes.
As we reported a couple of weeks ago, that there was the issue that the National Motor Museum has revealed that it's going to be searching for a new home from 2030. These things are never quite as simple as first reported, but basically we were drawn to some sources within the organisation that revealed that there were clearly some sort of difficulties to overcome between the entity that runs the venue and the trust that runs the museum part of it.
Because it's worth noting that the museum is on the Bewley estate, effectively. The museum does not own the four walls it's within, to simplify it.
Safe to say, there's an awful lot to work through because there's things like the Bewley Auto Jumble events, and they're simply series of events which I think are owned by the Bewley estate part of the business. And then there's the issue of the cars and who owns which car, the sort of financial split of ticket revenues and things like that. There's an awful lot to work through. There's also the issue of the archive collection, which is also part of the National Motor Museum, but is subject to a separate lease, which therefore keeps that on site until 2036. So that's got to be worked through as well. So there's loads and loads of detail to work through. But very much like I think we said last time out, we just hope that it all does get resolved amicably and that the people employed in either of the entities are going to be okay and looked after in the longer term. None of this is going to happen quickly. Let's face it, it's going to be quite a complex thing. Do keep an eye on it because I don't know about you guys, but I've had many happy times down at Bewley, both just sort of wandering the grounds, but going to the auto jumbles, going to the shows, but also going to the museum. So it's a fabulous place.
It's a real nice, relaxed sort of family atmosphere down there, isn't it? It's really nice.
Yes, I think it's a lovely thing. So we shall see. But anyway,
more on this story as it develops, even though you're hearing this 3 weeks after we heard anything.
Exactly that. Now, I thought I'd spend some time just revisiting our podcast that we did on facelifts, which went down rather well, actually.
Yes.
It seemed to spark a decent amount of debate. One thing I'm picking up, besides the conversation about facelifts, is that everyone likes a Renault Fuego, it turns out, which was my want of the week.
Yeah, never saw that coming, did we?
No, exactly. But listen to this. Joe was firing on all cylinders this week, totally with him on the Capri. I loved the Mark 1 and Mark 3, but hated the Mark 2. I think that was you and Jeff, actually, that said that. Yeah. And the initial oversized light ruined the look. For me, I'd go with the Granada to the Scorpio. There we go. One for you there, Jamie.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I had that, actually, on my as I'm sat there on the subs list, on my subs bench, waiting to see if Jeff's on holiday or not. I think I had that, actually, the Mark 3 Granada to the bug-eyed Scorpio.
Yeah.
Which is actually a really lovely car to drive, but just looks hideous.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, and this is an interesting one. One, both better and worse, the 944 to the Porsche 944 to 968. That's an interesting one.
I think I agree with that because it does look... I think the 968 objectively is not a bad-looking car, but that nose just doesn't work with the rest of the body. It works so much better with the pop-up lights.
I think that's a really good shout. The Alfa 166 was the best facelift ever.
Yeah, I wish I'd thought of that. Yeah, that's a fantastic one.
So, as ever, our wonderful audience listening and watching have contributed some absolutely brilliant contributions. Best facelift, Austin Metro to Rover Metro. That's quite a good one.
Ooh, yeah, I don't disagree with that. That's a good one.
My wheelhouse, yeah, absolutely. So there's some fabulous comments there.
I had a P38 Range Rover, actually, not because of what it looked like, but because of what it did for the brand. That was then the one that started the whole luxury brand for the Range Rover, and obviously the direction of that brand has gone since.
Yeah.
That was one I had on my list as well, actually.
The P38 Range Rover was a facelift of the Metro cab, wasn't it?
It wasn't a look, was it?
It wasn't.
In the absence of any sort of hardcore news, I thought I'd throw a conversation starter to the pair of you. And that is, I want us to discuss modern tech that annoys you.
Oh, how long have you got?
Yeah, this could form an entire podcast, to be honest, but I thought we'll try and keep it brief. So, Jamie, I don't know if you've got any particular modern tech.
That involves electric vehicles is one. Driver aids and stuff that are unnecessary, like lane keeping assist. And my biggest bugbear is bloody auto start stop thing. I absolutely hate that. And if you could just like map that out or turn that off from the beginning. It's borderline dangerous sometimes, especially if you're in an automatic. You're at a junction, you just go to pull away from a roundabout and it goes, actually, I'm going to cut off now. And then you lurch forward in front of them. Just in time for the oncoming traffic. You're like, oh, what's going on?
Well, it's all well good until the car is in its second or third owner and you have to replace a starter motor.
Yeah, well, even that aside and batteries and stuff, that costs you £300 because it goes through so many cycles. It's just anything that takes the control away from the driver. I mean, if it's supposed to assist a driver, that's fair enough. But when it starts making decisions for you, that's when I like, I don't like it.
But also someone said the engine's got to be off for about 60 seconds for it to have developed to get the emissions benefit from it being off in the first place. Otherwise, if you keep stop-starting it anyway. So if you're in that sort of traffic that is moving, it's not good anyway.
There's a guy in America does a YouTube channel called Engineering Explained, and he has done that test on a big old V8 thing. He was saying, I don't think it was 60 seconds, but I think it was somewhere in the region of about 30 seconds, where actually, because you use more fuel on a startup than you do just idling, you need to be stationary for, I think it was more than 30 seconds to see any benefit from a fuel-saving point of view, not on emissions, just from a fuel-saving point of view. And so you think about it, you're not, are you? Because you're sat at traffic lights. 30 seconds is a long time when you're sat in a car completely stationary. It just annoys me. I absolutely hate it. I can't see the point in it.
No. What about you, Joe? You're our young upstart. You should be embracing all this modern technology.
Yeah, I look young, but I'm actually middle-aged in my head. My modern Kia Ceed company car, it's got many, many buttons and features and assists and things. And there's a button on the steering wheel which you can map to anything you like. So you can have it go to the radio or to the sat-nav or whatever you want. This one button could be anything. I have mapped that button to my driver assist menu so that as soon as I get in the car, I press that button, I go to the menu and turn everything off. Just lane keep assist is the worst because it snatches the steering wheel out of your hand. Yeah. And particularly if you're on a British road, particularly if the road markings are a bit worn away, it can't tell where the edge of the lane is. So it'll be randomly grabbing the wheel out of your hand when you're just trying to drive straight down the road. So that's terrible. It will ping each time you go into a different speed limit. So if you go from a 30 to a 40 to a 50, back to a 40, back to a 30, every time the speed limit changes, it pings at you and tells you the speed limit. That can get in the sea. Yeah, it's awful. Absolutely terrible. And the one where if you do move in your lane, even with lane keep assist turned off, if you move over in your lane ever so slightly, it pings at you for 10 seconds and tells you to take a break. And again, from what I gather, since 2024, you have to have that in all new cars and you can't turn it off, which, yeah, I absolutely hate it. So when I drive my old cars anywhere, I get in, put my seatbelt on, start the engine, drive off. When I get in the Kia, it's turn it on, go to that menu, spend 2 minutes turning everything off so I can just drive uninterrupted.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of it.
The speed limit thing's interesting because actually it's not always correct either.
Like no.
There's a lag. I drop my daughter off at gymnastics. It knows the speed limit in the car park. Like, how does it even know that?
I didn't know that. Why would there be one?
But then you pull out onto the road and it still thinks it's 5 miles an hour. So it's bombing me because I'm doing 30 in a 5 mile an hour zone, but I'm not doing five. It's a 30 mile an hour zone. So it's actually fine.
Not to sound like old man yells at cloud, but things were better in the old days when we could just drive. I do genuinely think a lot of these systems encourage worse drivers because the more things the car is purporting to do for you, the less people concentrate. I mean, blind spot assist. What's that about? Looking in mirrors. I'd be curious to know now, because when I passed my driving test, which was 11 years ago now, 10, 11 years ago, I was sort of taught beforehand that you should do a really obvious, you know, make your mirror check. For those of you watching, do a really obvious mirror check, turn your head fully so the instructor can see you doing that. With a modern car with blind spot assist, can you just ignore it entirely and just let the car do the checks for you?
Yeah, exactly.
You say that as well, right? The little on blind spots. Mondeo Mark II, smallest wing mirrors in the world. I've discovered that this week. Absolutely tiny. You get it going, I can't see anything. I'm moving the mirror around. I can't see any. I've got a blind spot. I can't even see the back end of the car, let alone anything else. Do you know what I mean? It's just like absolutely tiny. So yeah, old cars, small mirrors. That's not bad. That's a bad recipe as well. But.
I agree with all of your choices. I have to say, I would put touchscreens as a catch-all. Modern tech development, I think, is just a disaster. I can understand the perceived benefits. It's probably cheaper to put a kind of an iPad in a car rather than loads of buttons. And there's a commonality to it as well. The operating system can be the same. You can change it to language and the unit measurements and all that kind of stuff. So there's clearly functional benefits. But like you, Joe, I get into my modern car, and to Jamie's horror, I have an all-electric car. I now have to put a PIN code in.
God,
to log in to the system. I'm waiting for the CarPlay thing to sync up, and that can take anywhere between 1 second and about 5 minutes. And there's no determining how long it takes to sync the phone up. So while that's then happening, I then go to the driver settings, like you. So I have to go to a button at the top, activate speed limiter, deactivate lane departure, and all this kind of stuff. But while I'm doing that, CarPlay will sometimes connect and cut through that process. So I have to go back and do it again. Like if you move the car, if in my car, if you like move a bit and go, oh, I've just remembered something. So you get back out and get something from the boot. You get back in the car and it's done it, reset it all again. So you've got to do it all over again. Like that is not progress.
You don't get this with old cars. I'm sorry.
Everyone loves a button, don't they? One thing on your touchscreen thing, Bill, is when you've got climate control settings through that digital display. So I just want to turn the blur on. I can't see where I'm going. I want to put the blur on up the screen or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't want to have to go through 15 different menus, and that side of the car could be 9 degrees and I could be 27 degrees. And just give me a button, turn it on. That's all I do. Yeah.
Hopefully, there will be a return to more analog instrumentation.
In modern tech's defense that I do like, though, is reversing cameras. I must admit that that's one thing that has worked.
For context viewers, Jamie has a Ford Ranger that is the size of a space station, so you kind of need that.
Yeah,
and the other car is a Kia Sorento 7-seater, so that's not exactly small either.
It's a lump, isn't it? Well, look, maybe the talk of 7-seater Sorrentos is the perfect segue into our buying roundup.
Oh, I almost never planned it.
Look at that. Let's go with that. Because this week, gentlemen, I'd like us to consider our versatile classic. So we did some sporty stuff. We've done coupes. Now I want really useful classic cars. They don't even have to be daily drivers as such, but I want them to have practicality at their core. So I want us to pick three versatile classics, but it's just there's a bit of additional criteria that I will no doubt ignore myself. One must be an estate car, one must be a 4x4, and one must be a 7 or more seater, so it can seat 7 or more people.
Well, one of my options probably is 7-seat 4-wheel drive estate car.
Well, let's kick off. Jamie, why don't you get us started? What's your estate car choice?
Well, my estate car actually gone for a Mondeo Mark III, ST220 in particular, but Mark III Mondeo Estate, because there is nothing you cannot get in the back of a Mark III Mondeo Estate. We've proven that time and time again. Absolutely terrible on fuel, if I'm honest, but sounded glorious, especially with a stainless exhaust on it. Sounded absolutely fantastic. Was very practical. Kids in the back, dog in the back, where I had dog guard in it and all sorts of stuff. Roof box on it if you really want to go to town and sort of carry everything you want. Really nice and comfy. It's going back to what we talk about modern tech, it's modern enough to be comfortable on the road, but old enough to actually still be enjoyable to drive where you haven't got touchscreen everything. It was all button radio, it had cruise control, and it had some other stuff. Yeah, it was a real nice car. Loved that. I still miss that thing.
A very handsome car. Very handsome car, that Mark III Mondeo, and probably better looking in a estate than saloon or hatch.
I think so. I bet everything's better looking as an estate car, isn't it? Let's be honest.
Oh, well, there's a discussion for another day. Anyway, Joe, what's your estate choice, sir?
Well, I will leave on that note. This one will spark some debate in the comments, I'm sure. So obviously, you've gone practical estate, 5 doors, you know, put the dog in it, put the kids in it, everything you want. I've gone for the estate car that's not actually very practical. Everyone's expecting me to go Mercedes, 123 or 124. And if I'm honest, I started to sway that way and I thought, nah, go wild for once. So I've gone for the Jaguar XJS Lynx Eventa, which is a coach-built XJS technically shooting brake, because it's only two doors, estate. They made fewer than 70 of these. I think 67 was the number they made. And they made them in Hastings, only 5 or 10 minutes from where I grew up. And they are gorgeous, absolutely beautiful things. The XJS proportions suit it perfectly. It looks absolutely beautiful. However, you don't actually get that much practicality because it's still an XJS rear seat. So still, you're barely getting children. It's certainly not adults. And the boot is still not that big because the roofline slopes. So yeah, you're still not actually, it's probably about the same boot space as an XJ saloon, to be honest.
Be very frugal, though, I'm sure.
Oh, well, it's only got a 5.3 V12. So
yeah, very, very frugal. So you get loads of miles to it as well. Yeah.
But it's beautiful and it's elegant and you can fit a golf clubs and enough bags for a weekend away and whatever. And I think there are a few cars classier than Lynx Aventador. They're absolutely beautiful and you won't find one. And they're getting over £100,000 now. And they're a terrible choice for carting a family around because you can't fit anything in it. And they don't make a tow bar for it. So you can't tow a caravan with it. In many ways, it's a terrible car for this choice. And yet I regret nothing. I love it.
Okay. So you've chosen an estate car that is not in the least bit versatile.
Yes.
We'll skip past it because they do look lovely. I think that's probably certainly true.
The least practical car ever.
Yes, well done.
I regret nothing there. They're fabulous.
Well done. Well done. Okay, good. Well, I applaud your slightly crazy choice, but I went through similar sort of thought processes. I did consider doing that XJ40 estate concept, but because
they only made one, you can't pick that.
It was never for sale, so I thought, well, I can't get away with that one. I then went to Mercedes, but I thought, well, you're bound to pick Mercedes, so I won't pick that one. And then I went Volvo, and then I thought, well, one step from there is Saab. So a Saab 9.5 estate looks fabulous, is a slightly cooler choice than the Volvo Discuss. But yeah, I love it and gorgeous. That for me blends style, performance, and practicality all in one handsome Swedish product. So,
is it that model of Saab that had the key down beside the handbrake?
Yep. Yeah, that's right. They're a great choice. And you can get them for next to nothing. They're really, big fan. That era of Saab, big fan.
Look, let's move on to our 4x4 choice. We've got the estate car for the dogs and maybe the trip to the beach or whatever. What if we want something maybe for towing or, you know, a bit of equestrian work? What 4x4 are we going for, Jamie?
Well, I don't do towing because I don't go and stay in caravans or tents or whatever. If I'm going on holiday, I don't really want to leave anywhere worse than my house. So it's sort of like, that's my golden rule on holiday. I'm not going on holiday anywhere that is worse than where I already live. So I'm not going in a caravan. I'm not going in a tent. I'm far too fat for horses. It would have to be a massive, great Shire horse to carry the weight. So it's like, so that's, cause I just want something that's got the higher driving position. There's one thing out there that I've mentioned it before on this podcast. I've got this M156 scratch that I really want to itch. And I did the ML63. So it's the M class, ML, with that same 6.2 litre M156, 500 horsepower V8, four-wheel drive. I'd probably go for one of them because they're not a fortune. And they are still practical enough to do. You can tow with them if you want. Obviously, servicing costs and whatever else mean that you know, you won't want to be replacing brake pads on them every 5 minutes, so you're towing too much with them. But yeah, just for the noise, it's just that sound.
That and engine is wonderful.
I just want that engine. I really want a C63 estate. It's probably what I should have gone for in my estate version one. But yeah, I want one of them. That's what I've gone for.
Good.
Joe absolutely hates it because it's an SUV 4x4. It's all the boxes of things that he would not ever want in a car.
And well, funny enough, off-screen viewers and listeners, when Jamie suggested that one, my first response was, oh, good engine, donor. So, yeah, I won't deny you that engine is fabulous. From a towing point of view, you may have provenance there, actually, because the boys from Top Dead Centre do tow with an ML63, and I think they reported doing 10 miles to the gallon while doing
it. What about miles to the gallon? Who cares about that? Who cares? But I'm only turning if I'm going away somewhere, right? It's not a day job thing, so don't worry about that.
It sounds like you should tow a petrol tanker, and then
don't worry about that. None of my choices are particularly frugal or ever have been. So yeah.
So come on in, Joe. Wow us with your non-SUV.
Yes. Now this was an interesting one because I thought, it's going to have to be practical, so I can't go for my actual preference of 4x4s is something small like a Panda 4x4 or a Jimny or something like that. But I thought, even I am not enough of a masochist to suggest that I would put a family of four in a Jimny. So I decided, right, the one 4x4 that I do have skin in the game with, i.e. my dad had two of them, is also one of my favourites. The Mark II Mitsubishi Shogun, which is a fantastic car. It heralds from the time when 4x4s were big. You know, you had the Discovery 2 and you had the Vauxhall Frontier and the Isuzu Trooper and all that kind of era, and the Jeep Cherokee, that era where big, knobbly 4x4s for the family were the thing. But the Shogun was arguably one of the first to do that, but to also be a refined road car. You know, it rode well, it had a nice interior, you could get wood and leather and electric windows and aircon, you know, a bit of luxury as well. We towed a caravan with ours, and you could barely tell the caravan was there. The thing would sit at 60 miles an hour, absolutely unbothered by it. They're comfortable, they're high riding, they're bulletproof reliable. They do have 7 seats in the long wheelbase one, so if you need that, you've got that as well. And off-road, they're 4x4, they've got low range, they've got locking disc and so on, so they're phenomenally, they're every bit as capable as a Discovery off-road. They are Japanese, so they do rock for fun. So the idea of finding one these days, they are quite hard to track down. But get a turbo diesel, 2.5 or 2.8, and they're 30 miles to the gallon realistically, which is plenty. They're reliable, they're practical, and they're fabulous. I think they're absolutely brilliant. I'd have one over a disco any day of the week.
And they have intercooler written down the side of them as well,
don't they? My dad had a 3-litre V6 one at one stage, and all I will say is I think that's the only car on earth that will rival your ML63 for fuel economy. That was awful. But yeah, get a diesel one, and I think the Shogun is a real underrated car as well. They're fantastic.
Yeah, where have they all gone? Have they just all rotted away? Is that what
they really have, yeah, sadly.
It is a shame, isn't it? We ran a Pajero import one on Car Mechanics magazine years ago, and I remember driving that, and it was so solid, really dependable. Yeah. It was a 7-seater one, it was a proper tank, and
they come from the factory with an inclinometer on the dashboard, so we can do that. I think there's nothing cooler than that. We're talking about unnecessary features in cars. Yeah, I want that. Even to go to the shops, I'm going to bump up the curb just so it does that a little bit.
Brilliant thing. So I think the Shogun's a good choice.
I don't think they look that old, actually. They still, they're that sort of like retro-y sort of vibe, haven't they? They're not too bad at all.
They've aged really well.
No, very good choice. Well, you mentioned one of its competitors, Joe, so I'm going to pitch the British offering here because I am going Land Rover Discovery. But crucially, I want to go for Land Rover Discovery 2. With the V8, ideally I'll go as late as possible before they go to Discovery 3, where things start to fall apart even more than they did with the Discovery 2. Are absolutely brilliant, even now. Now, you'll never use anywhere near the level of off-road capability unless you're sort of trying to drive up Ben Nevis or something. I think they look cool, even now. I love the sort of, the V8 engine is a joy.
That's still the old Rover V8, it is, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, 3.9.
I think it's 3.9, 7 seats. By the time you got to the late Discovery 2s, the seats, the back seat, those 7-seat ones sort of turn in and face forwards rather than sides, so you're knocking knees. I just think they're absolutely brilliant.
They are. They're so versatile. They just do everything.
Yeah. So I'd have one of those in an absolute heartbeat. You might need to make friends with a welder.
And a Land Rover specialist.
But being the V8, the parts are pretty good. You know, the mechanical bits are not the problem, actually. So it will be the rust and the boring stuff like electric windows, which will fail. So we've got our sensible estate car. We've got our 4x4 for towing stuff and driving into a boggy field to watch the local Gymkhana. So now we're going to go for a 7-seater to take the in-laws out for a day trip somewhere. You might choose to leave them there, but that's up to you. But we want a 7-seater. So you can take some additional people. What are you going for, Jamie King?
Well, I'm going to go for another estate car. In fact, I could have just done all three estate cars because I'd rather have just done three estate cars because there's so many options. So I went for a very loose interpretation of the rules. And initially I thought, what estate car can you get with 7 seats that I would actually want to own? And then they did do the Volvo 850 T5R. You could get, in all of that 850 range, you could get a 7-seat option. They are very, very rare. I would still go for one of those, but if not, my sort of slightly more attainable choice is the later V70R with the 7-seat conversion in. And that does tick all three boxes because that's 2.5-litre turbocharged estate car with 7 seats. And I'm fairly sure they're all-wheel drive. So that is my 4x4 7-seat estate car.
I think that's a fantastic choice. That's a connoisseur's car. That really is. If you see one of those at a car meet, you get a nod of respect.
I do love them. I would have one of them. I'd still have one of them now as a company car to plod along, and I'd swap the Ranger for a V70R. Probably get better fuel economy out of the Volvo, actually, but yeah.
Only just.
There's an endorsement. That is a cool choice. I approve. A very credible modern classic in its own right, I would say. Go on, Joe. What are you going for?
We've spoke the message many times of how anti-SUV I am, and I'm very firmly of the belief that the world should go back to MPVs, people carriers, because they are, as they say on the tin, a box on wheels. They carry 7 or 8 people. They got space. They got comfort. They got practicality. They got safety. I think the MPV is where the world should be going back to. And initially, I was going to go a bit leery. In my first thought that came to mind was Vauxhall Zafira GSI, because they did a turbo one. It does 140-odd miles an hour. You get them in that bright blue. They're properly leery. And to be honest, there's a subtle, understated chav. I actually really like them. But I thought, if I'm going to fly the flag for the 7-seat MPV, you should be the one that started it all to begin with. So my final choice is the Renault Espace Mark 1. Obviously, it was built by Matra. I believe it effectively dragged Matra under because of how badly it sold. But it showed to the world how practical you can make what is actually a relatively small footprint of a car. It's only about the same size as a saloon of the era, but you've got 7 people in it, and it was so versatile. It could be a bed. You could have all the seats turned in and make it into a meeting room. The 2 back seats lifted out so you could get then a van, effectively massively practical. It all twisted and rotated. You had that really wacky futuristic dashboard. From the outside, it had that dustbuster styling, Americans call it, with that big sort of shovel nose on it, which I think has aged really well. A fantastic, versatile car, and it was just practical for practical sake, and did it so well. And it drove like a big car. It didn't drive like a van. It was so well engineered. It was ahead of its time, and it only took about 10 years for the world to realize how good they were. If you can find a Mark 1 Espace now, that's a really, really cool, admired car. And I, as a styling exercise and a bit of history, I think they're a fantastic car. Bring back MPVs and the Espace in particular.
I think that's a really good choice. I'm glad you chose the Espace, because I was tempted to do it, but I thought, well, I've got another idea, and I'm
well, you're gonna go Zafira GSI.
Like you, I like MPVs, and actually I don't understand why we suddenly lurch from those to SUVs, because I think MPVs are better for that.
They
can carry more people. They're more versatile. You get the high up driving position that everyone bangs on about with an SUV. So I was very tempted by the Espace. I like that. But the one I chose, which was super rare, is the Toyota Space Cruiser.
Remember them?
It was I had the brochure. Went down to a dealer in Bromley or something on my bike and got the brochure for it. And I just remember loving that kind of chiseled styling and crucially the futuristic interior and stuff. I've found one for sale. It's a 1987 one with a 3-speed auto. We'll put it up on screen for those that are watching.
Wow.
That's one where you sit in front of the front wheels, don't you? Pretty much.
Mm.
Just like over the top of a van.
I just think it's brilliant. I would have that in a heartbeat. Yeah, the Japanese were probably doing MPVs before the Europeans and doing probably a better job. Because
I've just had a horrible realization that I've forgotten a really obvious Mitsubishi Delica.
There we are.
Why didn't I think of the Delica? Oh, can I renew my choice? Delica. The Space Cruiser is a cool car because it's, like you say, again, box on wheels, utterly practical. They are so rare these days that the pictures I've overlaid on this video are from that advert of one you found for sale, because there are hardly any pictures of them.
Exactly. Well, look, bearing in mind we're filming this massively out of kilter to when this actually broadcasts, I'm going to ask you, well, what are you up to in the near future? So you've got to try and think ahead now. This episode goes out on the 4th of September. So what are you up to in early September?
If it goes out on the 4th of September, tomorrow I'm at LZ World Tour at Castle Coon, which is on the 5th of September. I'll be up there doing some filming and having a little look for our sister channel, Fast Car, and seeing what's going on. See if we can find some
good
cars and some stuff up there. Basically having a day out watching some drifting and doing some filming with them. What about you guys?
Yeah, what about you, Joe?
Oh, I can't think that far ahead.
There's got to be a BSB meet somewhere.
Which are you going to there?
There's something going on. No, BSB stuff is a long way off. I'm going to take a random punt and say, let's assume the weather's nice. Sorry, this is the most ridiculous feature we've ever done in this podcast. What are you going to be doing in 3 weeks?
When's Rustival?
Yes, Rustival. Yes, we know about that. And that's coming up very soon. British Motor Museum, Gaydon. I cannot remember the date of it, but we'll be there. We'll be there filming a video. Do come along, say hi. Our friend Matt Furious has insisted we come along, so we shall be. I'll be coming along in my W123, which is in one piece, unlike his. So yes, we'll be along that. If you see us, say hello. Great show, always look forward to it. Phil, I hope you've got a more coherent plan than I do.
Well, I have a little bit, but not much more. I might be going to Stanford Hall for the British Mini Club meet. I've not been to it for absolutely ever, but British Mini Club, brilliant. They're a great bunch of people. they do three shows a year, and the Stanford Hall one is their kind of end of the season bash. It's in a lovely part of the country, nice and central, and you'll see some of the best minis in the country. So I might end up bumping into Jeff, no doubt, who will be back from his 95th holiday of 2026. This is also the first episode that we've been able to put out since we went to Trax at Silverstone.
Yes, indeed.
So Trax was on the 16th of August, so obviously a couple of weeks ago now. But I don't know whether you even managed to have a look round, Joe, when you were there, but I struggled personally.
I had a bit of a nosy, not a huge amount. I have to give a shout out to, I can't remember her name, I'm afraid. We ran a feature called Women in the Scene, which was celebrating exactly that. It's women in the car scene, making it great. It's not just for men, it's for everybody. And one of the women there turned up in her, quote, dream car, which was a Rover 220 Turbo Coupe. So yeah, that was a big highlight. Enjoyed that.
That's Louise Baker, and she's absolutely brilliant. Yes. Yeah, she's really good. Go and seek her out on Instagram and LinkedIn and all that kind of stuff. She's a real personality in the scene, a proper bona fide mechanic. No cares given. Turned up in her lovely Rover Tomcat, like you say.
Yep.
Best car of that display by far, in my humble opinion. There were some very cool builds there. I can't take it away from any of them. But what was good about that Women in the Scene bit, Joe, was that we weren't just talking about like a tokenist display. We had a racing driver, a drifter, a mechanic, you know, some real pucker petrol heads. There was very little pink, but 100% petrol. So it was brilliant. It was a really good display.
Absolutely. And then we will just give a quick shout out. We had as our special guest, Mark McCann, I'm sure many of you will be aware of on YouTube, the nicest man, absolute diamond, and yeah, lovely to great. Everyone. Brought his Bugatti Veyron along, and everyone had a good look around. Yeah, lovely, lovely guy. So thanks to Mark for that.
I think he did a personal meet and greet to about 10,000 people that day. He did quite well. But I was gutted not to spend more time in the paddock where the hot hatch display was, because I didn't really get to speak to any of the owners because we were just so busy that day. But there was a fantastic MG Maestro Turbo there, and there was a Citroen BX GTI, and I missed both of them. But as I left the venue at about 5:15 in the evening, the Citroen BX GTI man followed me out, and I'd sort of had to give him a little token wave because I thought he was brilliant. But
brilliant.
I did also make it up to Tatton Park on the Saturday before that as well. And again, what a brilliant variety of cars. A big shout out to the Toyota Enthusiast Club, who we've just done a bit of filming with recently. They were there in force with a fantastic selection of cars. But yeah, as ever, there was everything from a Ferrari to a Fiat 127 and
You did a good job with that one, didn't you? Thank you for all the nice comments, because obviously Robert Phil went up there completely solo and filmed that on his phone talking to a tripod. So yeah, fair play on that. That turned out very well.
Yes, well, thanks to your pretty very generous editing, which cut out all the ums and ahs and the waiting for people to pass.
Just don't get too good at that, or I'll be out of a job.
It was a lot of fun, though. It was great. We've said it before, but Tatton Park is a good backdrop to have some wonderful classic cars from that kind of area. Yeah, loads of lovely cars I'd have happily taken home with me that day. On to our final segment, which is the want of the week. The more spurious, the better. But a car that you want to put on your driveway, Jamie. So what have you got?
I keep seeing all sorts of stuff. There's AMG Mercs obviously pop up because my algorithm is so loaded to provide me with various Mercedes for sale at the moment. So I keep looking at that. But the one that caught my eye wasn't actually a Mercedes this week. It was, I think I mentioned it on a podcast a couple of weeks ago, but it's a Vauxhall, which was shock horror for the Ford man.
Ooh.
A Vauxhall Carlton GSI Estate. But it was a manual one as well. So it's a 3-litre GSI, 24-valve, dual ram. Ooh. It wasn't up for a fortune. So actually, that's quite a nice, sort of fairly usable car. It would fit my life. Do you know what I mean? So I don't really want something that's sort of 70s or 60s, because I never drive one and whatever. But that I'd get in and I'd be able to drive it around, do what I want to do with it. It's modern enough for me to do what I want to do with. And obviously, if you haven't gauged by now, I quite like some bit of poke under the bonnet, and that's got 200 horsepower. So yeah, it's
fancy.
That was my little want of the week.
A lot of love for Luton's finest there, Jamie.
But keep it going. There's some nice cars out there. So yeah,
very good. All right, and Joe, what's your want of the week, sir?
Again, for context, we're time traveling a little bit here. So I have been this week, or a few days ago, I was editing the video that went out by the time you see this, probably 2 weeks ago, which is our living with a pre-war car. Our friend Colin, who we filmed with before, he's got everything from a Ferrari Mondial to a Chevy Bel Air to a Series 2 Land Rover. Colin's fantastic, got a great collection of cars. his daily driver is a 1937 Morris 10. And he uses it to go to the shops, goes to the pub, everything. So we did a video on what's it like to live with a pre-war car. Can you use it every day? How fast can they go? What are the costs involved? Blah, blah, blah. And so I fell down a bit of a pre-war car rabbit hole. And I've ended up looking at Austin Sevens because I fancy a pre-war car. I'm still flying the flag for them. I found a couple of them for sale. There's this one I found on eBay, 1937 Austin Seven Ruby. Really, really nice condition. It's had a few sort of cosmetics done, a bit of mechanical brake overhaul and so on. That's $5,000, which in the world of classics for a car in that kind of condition, I think is pretty good. And then, obviously, good old Facebook Marketplace knew what I was looking at because it's throwing this one up. 1936 Austin 7, very nice colour scheme on that, sort of two-tone blue and black. It's had a Reliant Robin engine put in it, an 850cc, which is quite a common conversion on 7s, apparently. So that takes you up from 12 horsepower to about 40, 45, somewhere around there. So that'll have plenty of poke to it. Currently not running, apparently needs a fuel pump, but that's only $2,000. So I think if I had the space, that'd be straight on my driveway. I could fancy that.
It would explain why you started sharing Austin 7 ads on the group chat a little while ago. That was it then.
Raced those Reliant Robin engines in various different short oval race series. So you can tune them if you want as well.
The thing I got sort of looking at was more estate cars, actually. And then at Tatton Park, I saw an absolutely brilliant Montego Countryman.
Ooh.
So I remember these back in the day. It was probably the best version of the Montego you could buy, maybe outside the MG derivatives. But a seven-seater Countryman estate car was probably all the rage with families and minicab drivers and stuff back in the day. But of course, they've all gone. They don't exist anymore. So I really did struggle to find one. But I sort of landed on a sort of a fairly faded red example that looks more pink than red now. But it was up for 4.5 with the Rover grille, which means it's got the facelifted interior with the buttons where they should be rather than an ashtray.
I think we've touched on this before, that with cars like the Montego Estate, if you're looking for one, you buy the one that is on the market at the time.
Yeah, and we did have a project one, but it was probably a bit of a trigger's broom. But get a late one like that, and I think it's probably all right. And
information I remember about those, I'm fairly sure the seven-seat ones had a laminated rear screen as well, rather than a toughened rear screen for safety reasons.
Okay.
Whereas every other glass is obviously all windscreens are laminated. Most rear glass is toughened. I'm fairly sure because the rear seats were facing outwards, the rear screen is laminated on them.
Well, there's a bit of trivia you don't get on the Chris Harris podcast. There you go. So very good.
Well, look, that's been very useful. Thank you very much. Very versatile podcast today, chaps, in line with our buying roundup. So well done to all you watching and listening at home. Thank you very much for your ongoing contributions. Do get involved in the comments with your own suggestions of versatile classics. Take part in the game. One's got to be an estate, one's got to be a 4x4, and one's got to be a 7-seater.
Can you find an estate less practical than a 2-door V12 Jaguar? Yeah,
and try and do slightly better than an XJS Aventa. A Corgi model one might have more space. As ever, do get involved. Do give us a like, a subscribe and a follow. Give us a rating and a review. Anything you can do to spread the word of the Classics World Chat Show. It's always great to have you along and be part of the conversation. And we'll look back at the comments and review them on the next episode. But in the meantime, enjoy your week and we'll see you again soon. Bye-bye.
Later.
Bye-bye.